Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the results of this week's midterm elections brought a return to two-party governance in Washington. Democrats take control of the House in January, but the president's reaction was anything but conciliatory. My guest today, Susan Glasser, predicted before Tuesday's vote that there were few outcomes that could fix our broken politics. And if this week is an indication of what's to come, she's right. Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She joined me in the studio Friday morning. Susan Glasser, it's great to see you.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you, Diane. What
Thank
a treat.
You. Thank you. In your recent column, you call these midterm elections a rebuke and not a repudiation of the Trump presidency. What do you mean?
Well, look, I think there was a hope, not necessarily at all a realistic one, that somehow on the part of Democrats and Trump critics, even in his own party, that this might be a definitive message to the president. But of course, the Senate was never realistically going to go Democratic when you looked at which states of the one-third of the Senate that were up for re-election this year. And what I'm struck by is how Trump, in a very Trumpian way, has taken what by any measure is a significant rebuke of the president. This is now, by the way, the largest Democratic class in the House of Representatives since the Watergate babies of 1974. And yet Trump has chosen in classic fashion to ignore their existence as if the House didn't flip at all, and to treat this as what he called a very big win the other night. He said it was a near total and complete victory. Of course, that's not the case. But what's interesting is that he seems to be, in a way, almost believing his own spin, and he's taken a very aggressive response, which is to say, I don't believe the Senate can remove me from office, and therefore I'm going to do what I want. I'm not going to be constrained.
Susan, tell me about the recounts going on in Florida and Georgia.
Well, you know, we're all having a little bit of flashback, aren't we, Diane? At least those of us who are old enough to remember the Florida recount of 2000. You know, it's fascinating that both the House and both the Senate and the governor's race in Florida would be within the legally mandated margin of error to require a recount. Now, the actual count is not even done in those places. Georgia just seems to be an absolutely disgraceful example of every kind of miscue. And so we don't know the results of these hotly contested races in both states. There's a heightened concern because these are southern states, long subject to the federal provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Serious questions that both African-American nominees for governor in both states, that this would be the vote counting. I just think it undermines public faith and confidence in our political system at a time when, frankly, it's already undermined by the systematic assault of President Trump on so many of our institutions of our democracy.
So will these recounts continue?
I believe so. Yes, I do. And we'll see. Now, again, there's specific provisions for a machine recount, and then if it's even closer, for a hand recount of the ballots in Florida. So we'll see what actually occurs in both places. But I think you're looking at a very partisan fight over how even to proceed in Florida.
And what about absentee ballots? Have they already been counted?
Right. They haven't been fully counted. And that's the reason why we're not actually even at the recount stage yet in Florida. We're actually at the count stage still, which, again, is disgraceful.
I want to ask you about President Trump's press conference, because not only was it shocking in reality in how hostile he was to some of those reporters, especially the young African-American woman from
PBS.
Tell me about that encounter.
Well, Diane, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was also struck by that. We know that he has a long-standing sparring relationship with Jim Acosta from CNN, from Peter Alexander of NBC, who tried to defend Jim Acosta from CNN. But this one really leapt out. Trump seems to have a very conscious strategy of attacking journalists. Both those who spar with him were from networks that he doesn't like. But also, you wonder whether he singled out this young woman of color in order to have what looked to me like a pre-planned answer. She asked him an extremely professional and reasonable and indeed important and urgent question. She said, "Mr. President, when you called yourself a nationalist on the campaign trail, this was interpreted by many white nationalists and members of the extreme right wing in the United States as a message to them that you're with them. Was that your intention? And what did you mean by that?" He jumped down her throat, wouldn't even let her finish the question, and said, "This is a racist question." And again, I was struck by the fact that he repeated it as if he had this ready to go and he just couldn't wait to get out of the gate. She literally didn't even get her sentence finished. She was calm. She was professional. She handled a very unprofessional assault, I thought, by the president of the United States in a very, very collected way, but she didn't back down.
What do you make of the exchange with Jim Acosta, and that there may have been some change in the video of a young White House employee trying to get the microphone back from him? A question raised by the White House press secretary saying that Acosta put his hand on this young woman.
Well, Diane, it just... Isn't it? It's the whole thing is so sad and in many ways disgraceful that this is the conversation we're having after such an important election season. It seems to me, number one, the White House came out and was ready to have a conflict with journalists, that this was President Trump's strategy going into that press conference. Many people have pointed out the smiling faces of his advisors sitting there at the very beginning of the confrontation, as if they knew something was coming. I've studied that photograph several times. You see Sarah Sanders, Bill Shine, his new media advisor who comes from Fox News. You see Jared Kushner. They all look like they were primed and ready for the fight that then did in fact occur, number one. Number two, Jim Acosta. He's been a controversial figure in covering this White House. He doesn't handle himself in the way you or I might if we were sitting in that room. And I guess my view is that you don't have to like or even endorse the behavior of how journalists do their job to think that they have the right to do it. And that, I think, is the principle that is under assault right now by the White House. The First Amendment is not for popular people, and it's not for people doing things in the way that we expect them. It's an absolute right. It is unconditional. And the White House has really crossed a red line in going after and withdrawing the press pass of someone whose questions they don't like. Now, you raise the issue of that in and of itself would be obviously extremely worrisome to us journalists, number one. But number two, they've now even gone over the top in what appears to be the actual circulating of doctored video in order to undermine the reporter even more and to construct a false pretext for the withdrawal of this press credential. And, you know, I watched the press conference. You did as well, I'm sure. He clearly did not push or harm this White House intern in any way. In fact, the White House doctored video even took out the audio sound of him saying, "Excuse me, ma'am," which he said to this young intern as she was trying to grab the microphone away from him. Now, again, I don't want to get in an argument over his behavior, because my view is that the First Amendment is what's at issue here, and not how Jim Acosta does his job, but his right to do it.
During the press conference, President Trump was asked several times as to whether he intended to make changes to his cabinet, specifically asked about Attorney General Sessions, said, "Well, we'll see. I don't want to talk about that now." And the very next hour, almost, he announced that Matthew Whitaker would become the acting Attorney General. But what does it mean to take out Jeff Sessions?
Well, look, Diane, I mean, you underscored the sort of, it's not a comic opera here, but at times it can feel like it in terms of their handling of things. I think it was by design. President Trump was playing the press corps. You know, it's the illusion of transparency, not transparency. And that's consistent with how the White House views its role in communicating with the American people, which is to say, not at all. You know, Sarah Sanders, as you know, has eliminated essentially the longstanding institution of the daily press briefing that has existed for decades under both Republican and Democratic presidents. They are down in some months to, you know, a mere handful, you know, five or six a month, or even less, actually, in the month before these important midterm elections. That press conference, again, it makes a farce and a mockery of the idea that they are submitting to questioning by journalists on behalf of the American people, and to make such a major decision that he'd clearly already taken, and to lie essentially to the public in that press conference while turning it into a circus spectacle. It's very unseemly and depressing, and it's extraordinary to me that so many in President Trump's own party continue to enable this behavior, number one. Number two, it's very significant because, in fact, there are many even within President Trump's own party who are very concerned about the action he then took, which he didn't want to answer questions about, which was to appoint Jeff Sessions' own chief of staff to be the acting attorney general, someone who has not been confirmed by the United States Senate into any position here. And there are many, including conservative legal scholars such as George Conway, who is the husband of Kellyanne Conway, Donald Trump's White House counselor. He's argued in a New York Times op-ed that the appointment of Whitaker to be the acting attorney general is unconstitutional. And so this was very much by design. President Trump did not want to answer questions about this move that many view as a wild usurpation of power designed to undercut or perhaps to shut down the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of President Trump.
Matthew Whitaker has made previous comments about what he thinks of this whole investigation, which today President Trump said he's never even met Whitaker.
Yeah, he said, I don't know him. Obviously, he knows him. And in fact, there's a whole Shakespearean tale, really, of potentially betrayal where Whitaker was apparently in a number of Oval Office meetings, according to reliable accounts in The Washington Post and other news organizations this week, in meetings in the Oval Office with President Trump and Sessions, at which that's what impressed Trump, was that Whitaker was taking a more skeptical view of the Mueller investigation than the boss who had recused himself from it to Trump's fury. And that appears to be the reason that Trump, apparently without vetting this very controversial figure, decided to appoint him as an acting attorney general. And so there's that incredible tale of, like, how did he betray or, you know, stab his own boss in the back, number one, right? And number two, and even more consequentially, there's the question of having appointed a figure who appears to potentially be in violation of the Constitution. There will be grounds to sue on the part of those who wish to challenge any decisions of the Justice Department that he signs off on while he's the acting attorney general, number one. Number two, he has this public record of statements, including at CNN, of questioning the Mueller investigation, suggesting that Russians did not really intervene in a significant way in the 2016 election, also suggesting that there would be a way perhaps to starve the Mueller investigation of resources as a way of shutting it down. In any other normal Justice Department, this would be more than grounds for recusal to oversee the special counsel investigation, having already had a record of publicly speaking out against it. Since Watergate, the principle has held in Democratic and in Republican administrations ever since Watergate that attorneys general and their designees did not interfere in criminal investigations. That is a red line that, again, is being crossed by the Trump administration without us even having any way to register. This is something that is astonishing.
Susan, I don't understand how the president can even appoint him as an acting attorney general if as you said, according to these conservative legal scholars, that is unconstitutional.
Well, the question, Diane, is what's anybody going to do about it? And so you have a couple different options, neither of which, as I'm not a lawyer, I don't know which is the right approach. Is it something that Congress needs to challenge? Is it something that somebody needs to bring a lawsuit? Who has standing to bring a lawsuit? Already, that's what a lot of the conversation is about. Would a member of the Senate, for example, have standing to bring a lawsuit immediately against President Trump, given that the constitutional provision being abrogated here, it appears to be that of the Senate's role as giving advice and consent. And because the Attorney General of the United States or his designee is a principal officer, which means reports directly to the president, that person, even in an acting capacity, is supposed to be confirmed by the Senate. So would someone from the Senate have standing to object? Again, this is legally uncharted territory. Why? Because no other president would do this. By the way, President Trump has multiple Senate-confirmed officials in the Justice Department that he could have made the acting attorney general. Multiple.
Do you think as an acting attorney general, Whitaker could shut down the Mueller investigation?
Well, I think on the basis of the constitutionality of his being in the office alone, we would immediately be guaranteed a massive court fight, which would send us into constitutional crisis territory, absolutely comparable, if not worse, than that faced President Nixon during Watergate.
What options then do Democrats have?
Well, look, first of all, the first and most obvious option is for President Trump to back down. Now, as we know, President Trump doesn't like to do this and generally tends to double down rather than to back down. But in this particular case, you could already see that by Friday morning, a little bit of softening, reported sources telling some news organizations, well, he's looking at this. They were surprised at the conservative legal blowback. You know, so the obvious solution here is for President Trump simply to change gears and to say, well, for the purposes of this, we're going to, make someone else the acting attorney general. But as we know, he doesn't like to do that. Perhaps Mark Whitaker will find an urgent family situation that requires his immediate attention. If not, I think you are looking at potentially a constitutional crisis.
Now a quick break. When I return, more of my conversation with Susan Glasser.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Glasser, recorded Friday morning. Let's talk about the number of women elected to the House of Representatives, more now than ever.
Well, that's right. We're over the 100 women threshold for the very first time, and the largest number of women who've ever been elected. Let's just be clear from the start that it's not enough and it's nowhere near the 51% that it should be if America really had a representative democracy. The pace of change in many ways for women in our public offices as well as in private corporations, I think, has been astonishingly slow, and if you had to say to me one thing that, when I entered, professional life after college, the biggest single surprise would be at just how slow progress has been on this front.
Think about African Americans as well.
Well, that's exactly right. So on the one hand, this new Congress, especially in the House of Representatives, the Democratic majority caucus in the House of Representatives will be, I believe, majority not white male for the first time in its history. And this is a significant breakthrough. I believe it's largely fueled by the reaction and the backlash to the election of Donald Trump over the first woman nominee of a major party 2 years ago. So I think it shows that change can happen, that when it comes, it can even be swift in historical terms. This is a big reversal from just a couple years ago. But, you know, I wouldn't be sanguine because I worry that now women, minorities being represented have become a part of the political polarization in our country. And so you have this increasingly white male party, the Republican Party, and this increasingly more diverse party, the Democratic Party, when it comes to their elected officials. So in some way that worries me, the two parties are moving farther apart, even on this important question of how and whether 50% of our population will be represented.
So how united do you believe these Democrats are going to be, first and foremost, behind Nancy Pelosi?
Well, it's a really good question. You know, the odds certainly at the moment strongly favor Nancy Pelosi to be elected as Speaker. That would make her, as my husband pointed out the other day, both the first and the second woman Speaker of the House of Representatives, obviously a number of years apart in which she was the minority leader and her party had lost control of the House. The Republicans and President Trump really trying to make her part of the campaign issue this year, tried to nationalize this as a race between Trump and Nancy Pelosi. Now, that, of course, wasn't entirely successful. She's not nearly as well known of a political figure. She doesn't have as much of an identity. He tried to call her a San Francisco liberal. She's long represented a House district from San Francisco. You know, that demonization to a certain extent was affected in that you had a number of House candidates, Democrats running in Republican districts won by Trump, who were either reluctant to endorse her for leader of their party or even outright came out against her. The current count that I saw this morning was about 10 Democrats who've said publicly that they wouldn't vote for Pelosi for Speaker on the floor. Now, as you know, they're having a relatively narrow majority in the House, but still there would be more than a 10-seat cushion there. So she'd probably win anyways. We don't know whether they'll go through with that or not. There's not really a viable candidate other than Pelosi. There's no one who's emerged in a significant way to challenge her. And so in my view, she is going to become the Democratic Speaker of the House.
Even more challenging seems to be the fact that Trump is forcing everybody to play by his rules. I mean, he's saying things that are untrue and making people argue against him.
You know, Diane, I'm so glad you brought that up. I wrote about that a little bit in my New Yorker letter from Washington this week because I feel like Trump critics have had a hard time really acknowledging how successful he's been in many respects in shaping and reshaping the contours of our political discourse. Obviously, the caravan, remember the caravan? That's a pretty stark example, but there are so many others. The firing of Jeff Sessions 6 months ago was a red line, and even Republicans like Lindsey Graham said it was, you know, there would be hell to pay if Trump did it. Well, he waited long enough. He got us used to the idea of something that was previously unthinkable, and then he did it. That's how would-be authoritarian leaders operate in almost every society, consolidating power. I watched it happen in Putin's Russia in the first 4 years when Vladimir Putin came to power and was reconsolidating power in the Kremlin, taking control over previously independent institutions of the media, independent business figures, for example. I remembered, in the assault on Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the wealthiest man in Russia, who, as you know, emerged then and is now a Putin opponent in exile, spent 10 years in jail. Well, first they said, well, that he's just going after his company. It's just a business dispute. Then they said, okay, well, they arrested some of the people around him, but it's never going to touch Khodorkovsky. And then they stopped Hodorkovsky's plane on a tarmac, dragged him off of it, and he spent 10 years in Siberia. And now, that's not going to happen here in the United States. There are more meaningful checks and balances, not to mention a 200-year history of representative democracy in this country. But the reason I bring it up is because I believe that President Trump's instincts, his responses, and in particular, his ability to accommodate the American political conversation to the previously unthinkable is exactly what we've been experiencing over the last 2 years.
But that is why I find myself worrying that democracy itself is at stake.
Diane, I do too. I do too.
You feel the same way.
You know, it's very interesting. I am so lucky to have been a product of what, in hindsight, you know, I guess was a historical exception. But I graduated from college exactly at the end of the Cold War. In fact, you and I are having this conversation on November 9th. It is the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And today, by the way, this is fascinating. The Berlin Wall has now been down as long as it was up. But I was a senior in college when that happened.
And if I may say, it's also the anniversary of the end of the First World War.
That's exactly right. It's the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. It's also, by the way, the anniversary of Kristallnacht in Nazi Germany, which was, I think, the moment when many people in the United States and elsewhere around the world understood and the veil was once and definitively for all off of what was really happening inside of Hitler's Germany. And it's the anniversary of a much more hopeful anniversary, November 9th, 1989. I was a senior in college. And, you know, in hindsight, we were wrong, of course, but there was this feeling that freedom and democracy were on the march, that this was a new stage of development, that maybe it wasn't the end of history, as Frank Fukuyama wrote, but that it was certainly a period when tyrannies were collapsing and there was going to be a new, they called it the Washington Consensus. And, you know, now we're looking at a period where for the last 12 years in a row, Freedom House has said that the number of democracies are going in reverse. That's 12 years in a row. So it predates Donald Trump. He may be a symptom of it rather than the cause of it. But I look at what's happening here inside the United States, and there's so many developments that you and I never thought were possible. And it does show you that human material is unfortunately the same the world over. And for those people who believe bad things can't happen here in the United States, you know, I think these last 2 years have challenged that assumption.
Susan, another terrible shooting, this time in California. Are guns going to be back as part of the debate?
Well, you know, it's an amazing and horrifying thing that's happened in the country. There's something more than 300 mass shooting incidents that have occurred just in 2018 alone. 300. In any other country, this would be treated as such a massive public safety and legislative crisis. I do think that many of those new members of Congress who were elected in this Democratic wave to the House of Representatives believe that part of the reason they succeeded in the suburbs, even in traditionally more Republican suburbs, is it a wave of revulsion, not just about President Trump, but specifically about this gun issue. So I do believe that it's going to be much more politically on the table than it has been in recent years. There's the incredible story. This race was one of the ones that was very close, but was just called yesterday on Thursday after the election in the suburbs of Georgia, a seat once held by Newt Gingrich himself, the architect of the Republican Revolution. Now a Democratic woman was elected whose own son was gunned down, I believe, in a convenience store shooting just a few years ago. I imagine that she and many other new members of Congress are going to come very passionately believing that this is something that has to be on the national agenda. Whether they can get anywhere or not, I don't know. But I think that it's going to go down in the long view of history as a disgraceful chapter.
A shameful period,
yes,
in our history. Let's talk about the Senate. Overall, Democrats received more votes but ended up losing two seats. How come?
Well, you know, we're still waiting to see the final tally. It could be anywhere from losing one seat only to losing three seats, I think. You still have this race in Arizona as well that's very close. That looks like the Democrat may actually pull it out, even though it looked like on election night that it would be the Republican. That's for John McCain's old seat Jeff Flake's old seat. Then you also have this Florida race that's going to a recount. So there's still some uncertainty there. You know, the popular vote isn't really an indicator of the Senate outcomes because, as you know, actually the least populous states are more represented. And so that number can be, unfortunately, a little bit misleading in terms of what it means in terms of Senate seats. This was by design. Of course, the founders didn't anticipate the level of urbanization in the country, but they wanted to make sure that the Senate reflected the composition, the geographic composition of America, regardless of population. You know, and increasingly, that's not a good fit with where our parties have sorted themselves out to be. Democrats are a party of the coasts and of big cities. Republicans are a party of the interior and small states, rural states. And so you have the conflict pronounced there. And also the one-third of states that had Senate elections this year were even more disproportionately those Republican red states. That's not going to be true 2 years from now in the 2020 election.
So the president talked a great deal at his press conference about compromise. Do you really think compromise is possible? What will the Democrats do with their majority in the House?
I would say that the last thing in the world that we're going to see in the next 2 years is unity, bipartisanship, and an enormous record of legislative accomplishment. Number one, there is, of course, the controversial figure of the president himself. And because of the nature of how polarizing and divisive he is as a leader, his own instincts are to fight and to divide. And then B, Democrats have constituencies who quite frankly loathe the president in a way I've never seen in my lifetime. I was very young during the Nixon presidency. That's probably the most comparable period when the other party felt so personally strongly about the president. That, of course, mediates against unity and bipartisan compromise. And then the other factor is just the sifting and the sorting of this country. There's a very interesting statistic I mentioned in my column this week, courtesy of Doug Sosnick, who used to be President Clinton's chief political strategist. He pointed out back in the 1980s, as much as half of the United States Senate was elected and came from states that voted the other way in the presidential election. By the 10 years ago, that number was down, but it was still one-third of the United States Senate. Today, the number is seven. Only seven U.S. senators represent states that went the other way in the presidential election, which means the political incentives are to stick with your party no matter what. And so I think that's what's going to happen.
So what can Democrats do in the 2 years?
Well, they certainly have subpoena power now. They have control over committees. They have the power of the purse and appropriations bills that need to be passed in order to fund the federal government. So they have, some pretty significant powers assigned to them directly by the Constitution that they're going to exercise in a much more vigorous way than the Republicans have been in the last couple years. And that means a lot of attention obviously focused on the kinds of investigations and oversight of the president and the executive branch they may undertake. But also on the legislative side, there is incentive, obviously, to work with the Senate, if not with the president himself, to get spending bills passed. People will be looking for the things that both parties still agree upon. Generally speaking, by the way, there are many issues that both parties do agree upon. What tends to happen is when the White House or when the president gets involved, that's when an issue becomes toxic for the other party. So, you know, they want to keep from escalating as many issues as possible in order to get at least the basic work of the government done.
Last question, Susan. How do you think this election bodes for 2020?
You know, right before I came here, Diane, I was looking at a very interesting commentary from the Cook Political Report's House expert, who was very on the mark, by the way. And you have to give plaudits to the Cook Report and to many others who accurately foretold, more or less, based on their analysis, exactly what was going to happen in this election year. The pre-election forecast had gains of between 30 and 50 seats for Democrats in the House and gains of up to 5 seats for Republicans in the Senate. The picture was less clear there. That's exactly what has happened. It looks like it'll be about 35 seats, maybe a couple more, close to 40 seats for Democrats in the House. They nailed it, more or less. Well, what are they saying going into 2020? The battleground has shrunk. You know, when I was young, when you were young, there were many seats. In 1976, that contested election between Ford and Carter that was really close, 24 states in the country were seen as toss-ups in the presidential election. This analyst said that there are only going to be 6 states that might be the real battleground in 2020, that it's a map that's shrunk and everybody else is more or less going to carry out their assigned partisan roles. Now, we'll see, of course, it's very early, but I think that's one dynamic that's going to shape things, number one. Number two, President Trump, remember, did not even win a majority of the popular vote in 2016. Hillary Clinton did through a quirk of the Electoral College, in which particular states he ended up very narrowly winning. He won the Electoral College and thus the presidency. That's our system. But he's gone down in both popularity and in votes in key places in the Midwest that delivered him the election in 2016. And yet this year in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Democrats had huge successes across the board in governorships, in House races. So that doesn't bode well for Trump going into 2020.
You never know.
You never know.
Susan Glasser, great to talk with you.
What a treat, Diane. I am just so delighted to be with you today.
Thank you. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urib-Litker and Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.